ready? Okay, we're going to get started, everybody. There are a few seats open up front here if you're looking for a place to sit. And thank you all very much for coming. Welcome, everyone, to this evening's panel discussion, Can a Biologist Trust an Evangelical Christian? Sponsored by the InterVarsity Graduate and Faculty Ministry at Indiana University and the IU Student Association. We chose this topic in response to the IU thematic semester, or themester, on evolution, diversity, and change. My name is Luke Corwin. I'm a postdoctoral fellow in the physics department and a leader in InterVarsity at IU, and a Christ follower. You may have noticed that I did not use the word evangelical to describe myself. Although the dictionary and biblical definitions of evangelical accurately describes my beliefs, in contemporary American culture, it has acquired a host of other connotations. The stereotypical evangelical Christian culture is deeply anti-intellectual and forces its members to choose between their faith and good science, like biological evolution. It is inaccurate and unfair to apply this stereotype to all of my fellow believers who call themselves evangelical, but the distrust it cultivates is nonetheless real. It is that false choice we hope to start eroding and trust that we hope to start building in our discussion tonight. I would like to extend our sincere gratitude to our panelists for the time and preparation they have given to this evening. Tim O'Connor received a BA in philosophy and psychology from the University of Illinois at Chicago. He then received a PhD from Cornell University. He has been a research fellow at the universities of Notre Dame and St. Andrews. He is a professor and chair of the Department of Philosophy at IU and a member of its Cognitive Sciences program. He is also a member of the Society of Christian Philosophers. Dr. O'Connor has lectured widely in the U.S., Europe, and Asia and has published 50 articles in the areas of metaphysics, philosophy of mind, and philosophy of religion. I can try. He is the editor of 5 volumes and the author of Persons and Causes, The Metaphysics of Free Will, Oxford University Press, 2000, and Theism and Ultimate Explanation, Blackwell Press, 2008. He has recently lectured on topics at the interface of science, philosophy, and religion at international conferences involving physicists and biologists. This term, he is teaching an introductory course on religion and evolution. Richard Holdeman, in the middle, is a graduate of Yale University, where he received a Bachelor of Arts in Biological Psychology, and of Indiana University, where he earned a PhD in Molecular and Cellular Biology. He has been teaching as an adjunct faculty member in the Department of Biology at Indiana University since 1997. In 2005, he graduated from the Reformed Presbyterian Theological Seminary with a Master of Divinity and was ordained as a minister in the Bloomington Reformed Presbyterian Church. In addition to interests in science and theology, Holdeman is an avid sports enthusiast. He coached the Indiana University Ice Hockey Club team for 13 seasons and retired as the coach with the most wins in the history of the program. Without a doubt, his strongest asset is his wife, Amy. They have been married 20 years and have 4 daughters ranging in age from 1 to 13. Jeff Hardin received his Bachelor of Science in Zoology and Bachelor of Arts in German from Michigan State University. He then went on to pursue a Master of Divinity degree at the International School of Theology in Southern California. After seminary, Jeff returned to science at the University of California, Berkeley, where he received a PhD in biophysics. After postdoctoral work at Duke University, Jeff joined the zoology department at the University of Wisconsin in 1991, where he is currently chair and full professor. His research focuses on early embryonic development using the nematode C. elegans as a model system. He has been funded by the National Institutes of Health, the National Science Foundation, and the Muscular Dystrophy Association. Jeff is also faculty director of the BioCore program, a 4-semester honors biology sequence. Jeff is the only scientist who is a professor of religious studies at UW-Madison. He is the co-director of the Isthmus Society, which promotes dialogue between science and religion on the UW campus. Jeff was recently featured on the Big Ten Network show Office Hours, talking about religion's perspective on Charles Darwin. Our moderator, Carolyn Harkaway, is a doctoral student in the departments of English and Religious Studies here at IU. She is particularly interested in women's religious practices, mysticism, and theology in the 13th and 14th centuries. Before coming to IU, she received her Bachelor of Arts from Hope College in 2004 and her Master of Arts from The Ohio State University in 2007.
Before we begin, we have a couple more. I know nobody likes to sit in the front, but there are two more seats up here, and I don't know if there are any, I think there's one more back there, so if anybody's standing and wants to, there's one more back in the corner. Anybody wants to? No takers?
Each of the three panelists, me being the first, has been asked to begin our session tonight with some opening remarks. So asking academics to have brief opening remarks is quite a challenge, but we will try to do the best we can. Can you hear me in the back? All right. Okay, terrific. Well, again, my name is Jeff Harden. It's nice for me to be here. I want to apologize for the outcome of the most recent football game. But IU is looking strong. I think they're going to have a good year next year. It's really a pleasure for me to be here. I want to thank the organizers for inviting me. And this is my second time at IU. It's really a wonderful campus. I have to say that when I was invited to speak on this topic, can a biologist trust an evangelical Christian? Well, in one sense, I immediately thought, why should we have to talk about this? I mean, after all, I'm chair of a zoology department elected by my colleagues in the department. In 18 years of teaching, I've never seen a statement on my teaching evaluations questioning whether I know what I'm doing in the classroom and that I could be trusted to convey the information. There's certainly been other things on those evaluations, but not that. And yet, in another sense, I'm acutely aware, because of friends and colleagues at the University of Wisconsin and through participating in events like this, that trust is an issue. And let me begin my remarks by conveying two stories about two students that I've interacted with. One is a woman named Tina Lockwood, who got her PhD in my lab. And while she was in my lab, Tina taught a fifth grade Sunday school class at a local church. And one day when she was teaching the children, she said, "Well, children, if you could ask God one thing, what would it be?" And there were lots of different responses. One little girl very timidly put up her hand and said, "Well, I'd ask him if it's true." And Tina said, "Well, ask him if what's true?" And the little girl said, "I'd ask him if it's true that all scientists are going to hell." And We chuckle in one sense, but we cringe in another, don't we? Because it says something very strong about the culture that this little girl had been exposed to. The issue was trust. Could you trust a scientist? The other story I'll relay is about an undergraduate who is now getting his PhD in plant sciences at UT Austin, named Jeremy O'Connell. Jeremy came to me after some of my cell biology lectures because he noticed that my hard drive was named Narnia, and if you know anything about that word, it's a series of children's books by an author named C.S. Lewis, and this caught Jeremy's attention. And he came in to talk to me, and he poured out his whole life, and basically he relayed that he had been brought up in a very conservative situation with particular views about the age of the Earth and other issues about biological diversity. And he'd come to the university, and he had heard lectures in the classroom, and he felt that he was backed into a corner. Either he could retain his faith, or he could jettison his faith and embrace what he was learning in his science classes. And so Jeremy and I talked for a period of months and went through a number of readings together to help him through this. And these two stories, I think, pinpoint some of the issues of trust that we're facing. both within communities of faith and outside them. Now, very recently, you may know that Francis Collins has been tapped by President Obama to be the director of the National Institutes of Health. And there have been a number of op-ed pieces criticizing this choice because Collins is an outspoken Christian. And one of these was written by a fairly well-known atheist author named Sam Harris, an op-ed piece in the New York Times, and he said this: "There's an epidemic of scientific ignorance in the United States. It can be difficult to think like a scientist. But few things make thinking like a scientist more difficult than religion." So he says it straight out. And indeed, there is this sense that somehow a person of faith, particularly particular kinds of Christian faith, is simply unable to evaluate scientific evidence adequately and wrestle with what nature gives us in terms of how we do science. So these issues kind of frame everything that we're going to say tonight, and that's by way of a bit of introduction. And what we'd all like to respond to is this fundamental issue of trust. So I'm a practicing biology professor, and certainly this issue is a very real one for me. But I want to address in my remaining time three reasons why I think it's possible to trust a biologist who is also a Christian, as I happen to be. And the first of these, I think, is that the Christian worldview encourages us to study the living world. You may or may not know this, but in the frontispiece to Darwin's Origin of Species is a quote from Lord Francis Bacon. And Bacon said this: "Let no man think or maintain that a man can search too far or be too well studied in the book of God's word or the book of God's works." Bacon is bringing up a fundamental idea that we learn things about the one who stands behind the creation by studying that very creation. We learn other things from other sources of information. In Bacon's case, he's referring to the Bible. And in fact, the Christian worldview makes this case quite plainly. And really, this two books idea comes from a number of passages, but in particular, a very nice piece of poetry from the Old Testament called Psalm 19. In the first two verses of Psalm 19, the psalmist says this: "The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day they pour forth speech. Night after night they display knowledge." Well, there it is, a poetic description of the regularities of the heavens. And in fact, the psalmist goes on to talk about this in what C.S. Lewis, who I mentioned earlier, calls one of the greatest pieces of poetry ever written. But the first part of this psalm is all about, in figurative language, poetic language, the regularity of natural processes. The regularity of the heavenly bodies are an unspoken testament to the one who lies behind it, according to the psalmist. And indeed, the psalmist kind of luxuriates in the wonder of all of this. And in fact, he says that these heavenly bodies pour forth. It's sort of like a bubbling, babbling brook. It's irrepressible. That we learn things about the Creator through what we observe in the natural world. Now, that's a radical idea if you wind the clock back about 3,000 years. Because in the ancient Near Eastern cultures around which the culture from which this psalm arises believed it was that, in fact, heavenly bodies, well, they were deities. And the biblical worldview says, no, that's not the case at all. The sun, the stars, the moon, rivers, living things, they are not deities. They are simply interesting things. And they reflect the creativity of their creator. And indeed, this biblical worldview says a number of things. First of all, that nature is real. That may seem like a strange thing to say, but Tim maybe will address that point in his remarks. I'm not sure. But certainly, the good news for the scientists is that nature is intelligible. One can observe its regularities and plumb their depths. And thirdly, it's a contingent and independent creation. It's a unique work of art. Much as an artist produces a work of art that stands on its own and we can observe it and study it, so the natural world does. And we can study it and perhaps the creator that stands behind it. Now, in the biblical worldview, this doesn't mean that God supernaturally interacts with the world moment by moment, sort of miraculously. No, the creation has an integrity that allows this regularity. In the New Testament, the writer Paul says it this way, "For by him all things were created, he's before all things," this is Jesus in the New Testament, "and in him all things hold together." So in other words, the natural order relies on God moment by moment for its existence, but its regularity is something that anyone has access to. And this allows it to be studied, particularly by scientists. So it's this createdness that allows it, that allows the natural world to be studied. So that means that the Christian worldview is not inimical to science, but it's very compatible with being a scientist. And in fact, throughout history, one can find really wonderful examples of scientists who were playing out their own faith through their science. We'll talk about that in a little bit. My colleague David Lindberg at the University of Wisconsin has done a nice job of fleshing out the fact that this Christian worldview was not a problem for the origins of science, but was very compatible with the origins of science in the late Middle Ages and during the Renaissance. Now, Christianity is not the only story there. Certain things that were coming from Islam and other places. But nevertheless, the Christian worldview makes it possible to be a scientist and encourages us to study the creation. Now, the second thing I'd like to say is that the Christian worldview enhances the personal life of a biologist. And it's that enhancement actually makes me, I would like to say, a better biologist than I would be otherwise. See, for a Christian who is a biologist, studying the created order is not just something that has with it, although this is certainly true, the excitement of intellectual discovery and the satisfaction of figuring out the way the world works. It's also an act of worship. And indeed, Christians who were scientists throughout the ages have thought about it in this way. Johannes Kepler, you may know about his astronomy work, establishing the elliptical orbits of planets. He was thinking God's thoughts after him. That's how he described what he was doing. Isaac Newton, although he had some funky theology, certainly a Christian theist. Michael Faraday, James Clerk Maxwell, 19th century physicist slash chemist in the case of Faraday, also very devout Christians. All of these men viewed what they were doing as part of their worship to God, trying to understand his creation. Now, more recently, we've mentioned Francis Collins, and I mentioned he's an outspoken Christian. Well, here's what he said about his work on the human genome. "The work of a scientist involved in this project, particularly a scientist who has the joy of also being a Christian, is a work of discovery which can also be a form of worship. To have a chance to see the glory of creation, the intricacy of it, the beauty of it, is really an experience not to be matched." Now, Collins did his work with excellence, and practicing biologists like me rely on the work of the Human Genome Project every day. And yet, he saw it in a larger context as well that gave his work an added richness. And I would say, as a Christian who's a biologist, when I can discover something new about how an embryo works, I feel a sense of satisfaction, yes, but I also feel that I'm better able to appreciate the work of art, which is the world, and thereby more really better appreciate the one who crafted that world. So I'd like to argue that the Christian worldview is not inimical to science. It allows for an independent creation that's contingent, and we simply have to learn how it works by doing science. Being a scientist who's a Christian allows me to do biology in a context in which it's very exciting on a personal level, but also a professional level. And then finally, I'd like to make the case that being a Christian, if I'm doing my job as a Christian, living that out faithfully, that Christian worldview should encourage certain epistemic values which are important for the business of doing science. Psalm 19 goes on in the second half of the psalm to switch gears, talking about that first book in the first six verses, and then moving on in the last half of the psalm to talk about that other book, the book of God's Word. And listen to what it says. It says, "The law of the Lord is perfect, reviving the soul. The statutes of the Lord are trustworthy, making wise the simple." And the psalm finally concludes by the psalmist asking May the words of my mouth and meditations of my heart be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, my rock and my redeemer. Now, we've made a shift here, haven't we? The world tells us certain things. But as a Christian, I have the conviction that there's another source of information from one author, the book of God's world, but also the book of God's word. And by reading that, I can learn in a personal way what this artisan is like who has created the world that I study. And indeed, you'll notice that the verse that I read for you says that there's something wrong with us. And indeed, the Christian worldview would say very strongly that although we are magnificent creatures, in other ways, we're very limited and very flawed. And the Bible's very straightforward about that, I think. And indeed, one of the things we need is wisdom. And this suggests that Christians, rather than being a source of distrust, if anything, should be humble, because they understand their limitations. They understand the need for wisdom. They understand the need for their own work to be checked and to do that in a context of peers. Ultimately, Christians, like other scientists, need to rely on this network of trust, and Christians, more than others perhaps, ought to inculcate that kind of community of reliance and humility. Stephen Shapin, a wonderful social historian of science, wrote a book called The Social History of Truth. And in that book, on the last page, he talks about this fact. He says, science is a system of knowledge by virtue of its being a system of trusting persons. Scientists know so much about the natural world by knowing so much about whom they can trust. So trust is important. And I'd like to think that as a Christian, I am inculcating in myself character qualities which will help me be worthy of the trust of other scientists. So this all sounds great, doesn't it? I mean, after all, being a Christian seems to set up a situation where the world is just begging to be studied. Secondly, there's personal fulfillment in doing science. And then third, we'd like to think that it might have the opportunity for creating certain kinds of character qualities that would help you be a good scientist. So why is there a problem then? Well, I think there's a problem because certain scientists who don't share that worldview have used their portrayal of science to import their own worldview, and that the Christian community has pushed back, frankly, against that. Listen to George Gaylord Simpson in The Meaning of Evolution. Man was certainly not the goal of evolution, which evidently had no goal. He was not planned in an operation wholly planless. Simpson seems to be talking not about evolutionary mechanism, but about teleology or purpose in a way that seems to go well beyond the scientific evidence. Or someone you just had on your campus, Richard Dawkins. Probably one of his most famous quotes from The Blind Watchmaker. Charles Darwin made it possible to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist. That, to me, doesn't sound like science anymore in any way. It's about metaphysics. It's about a worldview of materialistic atheism. And frankly, when I hear that, it makes me cringe, because it causes people of faith who don't understand biology very well to dig in their heels. And that's not helpful. It causes them to throw the biological baby out with the metaphysical bathwater, and it's simply not helpful. Now, I'm committed to portraying the evidence about biological mechanisms in the courses I teach with as much accuracy as I can. And frankly, I see no conflict with my Christian faith in doing that. But when this kind of overstatement takes place, I feel I have to push back. Now, I'm a co-author of a textbook called The World of the Cell, and for years, the senior author of that was a good friend of mine named Wayne Becker. When he was in negotiations to publish this textbook, he was shopping it around to various publishers. And so he had a very rambling dialogue with one publisher. And the editor wrote back, and there was a paragraph in the letter under The Origin of Life. This was the heading. Topics to be discussed: cosmology, formation of Earth, primeval soup, first cells. This is usually far too briefly discussed, if at all. This discussion could also make clear why God is an unnecessary hypothesis. Well, Wayne replied to that with an equally rambling letter, he says, and concluded on page 4 with the following. One final point, though. I find myself profoundly disturbed by the comment under item B4 that, quote, this discussion could also make clear why God is an unnecessary hypothesis, unquote. Biology text has a responsibility to present and summarize our current understanding on explanations concerning the origin and evolution of life forms, and I would attempt to seriously do so. It has, in my opinion, no right whatever to theological pronouncements which are purported to derive from such a discussion. You might, by the way, wish to consider the appropriateness of a note of praise that God, in his infinite wisdom and patience, has not yet seen fit to declare you an unnecessary hypothesis. Now, Wayne's a gentle, dear Christian friend of mine, and normally he doesn't get riled up about such things. But I think you see the point. Metaphysical overreaching, whether it comes from the Christian community or from other segments of our society, simply is not helpful. Trust works in both directions. Now, finally, I want to make the case that trust requires dialogue, and you being here, you are part of the solution, in my opinion. Dialogue on this issue shouldn't be carried out by a few partisans, but by all of us. And indeed, Jeffrey Cantor, a philosopher, wrote in a millennial article in Nature in the year 2000 the following. Issues of science and religion are important to our civilization, far too significant to be left to either the devoutly religious physicist or the scoffing atheistical biologist. People holding different beliefs and forms of expertise need to work together in an open, non-confrontational environment, accepting both science and religion as valid aspects of human experience. It's a challenge facing the coming millennium. And I think that challenge remains, but I'd like to thank you for coming, and I hope tonight we can be part of that process. Thank you.